So if you guys have just been outside recently, right?
Yeah.
Well, pretty damn cold out there.
The prediction for today is wind chill in the 20s. So it's probably not really a good day to go out in the field. So we are going to have lab, though, and we'll just meet in here at 1:30. And the exercise is one that I have stashed away for rainy days or low wind chill days. And what I think you could probably look for is maybe getting started on what we're going to be doing is looking at land use interpretations and the basis for some of these interpretations as a function of soil morphology and site characteristics. And probably want to spend a couple hours on it. And this is something I like to have people work together in groups and then, you know, do it till you get sick of it and then take off. And let's just hope for some better weather next week, because this has not been a very good stretch, at least on Thursday. So it'll get nicer, I think. Okay, what we're going to start on today is the next unit, which is the section on the soil orders. And that's pretty much what we do from now until the end of the semester. And what we're going to be using is actually a combination of things. There is a 12 soil order website that I think some of you are familiar with, maybe from Intro Soils, and we're going to be using that a lot. And then I've got some supplementary material for you as well. And I'll kind of show you where to find that material. And I think it might be helpful. It looks like some of you already printed it out. And anyhow, if you haven't, I'll show you where you can get that. The other thing I wanted to mention, as we go through the soil orders, the stuff that I would really like for you to focus on as far as, you know, what to remember about them is, first of all, you know, what are the distinguishing characteristics? What makes gelosols different from any of the other 11 soil orders? And remember, these are mutually exclusive classification, so there are some distinguishing characteristics. And so pay attention to those. Also, just the environmental setting. We're going to see that some of these soil orders are found in, to varying extents, different environmental settings. Some are pretty narrowly defined, like gelosols. Others are pretty much widely distributed. So it's going to vary from one order to the next, but you should be somewhat familiar with the environmental setting of each. And also the geographic distribution. We'll be looking at maps that show where you find spodosols, where you find oxisols, and you should have a pretty good feel for where those are. The other thing to pay attention to would be diagnostic horizons and features. You know, we've been talking about those the last couple weeks, and you're going to see that within the soil orders, that these types of diagnostic horizons and features, they're prominently distributed in particular orders. So there's some fairly characteristic sets of these things that you'll find within a given soil order. And then the soil forming processes. A lot of these orders are characterized by a dominant soil forming process or processes, and we talked about those earlier in the semester. So you want to think about those a little bit. And finally, from the more practical standpoint, land use considerations. You know, these soils all have characteristics that really dictate what they can and cannot be used for successfully. And in some cases, they're pretty important characteristics that require a lot of forethought in terms of land use. And you'll see those come out. So here's the couple things. If you've never seen the 12 Soil Orders website, you can get to it from the course webpage here. I think it's right down here. It says 12 Soil Order website, and you click on that, and this will be the first page of it. So we'll be, as I said, using this quite a bit. The other thing I want to show you is where to find the other materials that might be useful as we go through these. Your textbook is a good source of general information about each of the orders. They're pretty concise. They're not long chapters. And a lot of the stuff that I'm going to be giving you comes directly from there. But what I would recommend is, if you look at the this presentations, and you get down here, for example, here's the Jellisol notes, and what it is, it's just the handout. Go ahead and click on it. I think these are password protected. Yeah, so you got to type in, remember the password? SBR13. And what you'll get is just this kind of thing. So you can print these out, look at them. And actually, a lot of this is just off of the website. So I'll leave it up to you what you think the best way to approach it is. The other thing, for each of them, there's something here that's called a supplement. Same kind of deal. It's password protected. And this is just maybe a few more images that are not on the website that I'll be going over. Okay, so any questions about those? And we pretty much do one soil order per class period. So if you're looking ahead, and I think it'll follow the schedule very closely. Okay, one other thing. This is in regard to the homework assignment that I gave you on Tuesday that's going to be due this coming Tuesday. And this is about the field trip we took down to Hawaii. And you sent me those photos. This may help you, it may not, but if you go to the lab schedule here, and you can see here was the Thursday, we went on the field trip. I've got links to three images here, courtesy of Kat, who took them with your smartphone. And I just went ahead and stuck them on here. Might jar your memory if you want to take a look at them. And I don't know, I guess it's up to you. Can people use them in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, I don't care.
Or do they need to get copyright approval from you?
Copyright,
okay, so no. You know, here they're here, you can use them however you want. And I'll leave the rest of that up to you. So those assignments, again, will be due on Tuesday. And if you're trying to find some more information about them, what I would suggest is if you look up the Missoula floods, you'll probably find some relevant information. Or even if you put into something like Google the term slack water sediments, you'll probably find quite a bit of information there as well. And there's considerable amount of information out there. So your challenge is really going to be to come up with a nice, relatively short interpretive sign. Remember, the attention span of the average American is very, very short. So you don't want to make something that's going to take 5 minutes to read. It's probably something that should take maybe about, 30 seconds or a minute to read. That's probably about the attention span of people visiting parks and you know, those types of signs. You think about the ones that you've looked at, and they're not long. So any questions about the assignment? Okay, so I want to get started on the first soil order. And let me go ahead. And one of the things that I've done, this website, we use it in the introductory soil science class, and there are a couple others. So it's really designed to be used at a few different levels. It doesn't have as much of the jargon in it that we've been using in this class. And one of the things I found is that in terms of the presenting soil taxonomy as a key, it's best to do it in a simplified fashion. So if you look at this first link here, it says information about the 12 soil orders, and you click on that. This is a very simplified key to the soil orders. This is the order in which they key out in soil taxonomy, but you'll notice that the definitions are really brief. For example, Jellisols says soils with permafrost within 2 meters of the surface. And once you look at soil taxonomy, you'll realize that seldom will you find something defined as simply as that. Histosols, organic soils. So this is kind of the central concept. But at the same time, I want you to be aware that there is a more precise definition to each of these. And I like to go through them. For example, you can see gelisols are the first order to key out here. And if we look at the, what I've done with this thing, this is actually taken from the current version of the keys to soil taxonomy. And we'll be using this in a couple weeks. You guys will actually be keying some soils out, and you'll get to see firsthand. But here is the way the key starts out, the exact wording. And this, again, one of the simpler ones. But it says, key to the soil orders, you start off with A, soils that have permafrost within 100 centimeters of the soil surface, or gelic materials within 100 centimeters of the soil surface, and permafrost within 200 centimeters. So pretty simple concept. It's about permafrost. And I think that you'll appreciate how simple this is when we get into some of the others that take about a page and a half to go through the requirements. So that's the gelisols and this concept of permafrost. And if you click on this, then you go to the page that has information about the gelisols. This may be a little difficult to read. How do you make text bigger?
You right click it and then you can hit mark those in.
Right click.
Maybe click on an image.
Click curl and then hit the plus button.
Curl and the.
With the keyboard.
Where's the. Curl?
Like the C
control.
This doesn't have one of those. Is it the same as control?
Oh, control, yeah. Sorry.
Okay, and plus?
Yeah. You might have to click out of the.
Okay, that's a little bit better. This first page for each of the soil orders is just the general information. And it gives you, first of all, the derivation of the word. You can see gelisols comes from the Latin word gelar, which means to freeze. And these are soils, very cold climates, have permafrost within 2 meters of the surface, limited geographically to the high latitude polar regions and localized areas at high mountain elevations. And because of the extreme environment where they're found, gelisols support the least amount of human population of any of the soil orders. It's estimated maybe less than 0.5% of the Earth's population live on gelisols. So they're not really the soils where you find great concentrations of people, and there are good reasons for that. And as far as the distribution of them, gelisols occupy, it's about 9% of the Earth's ice-free land area, and it's about almost 9% of the U.S. land area. But most of the gelisols that we have are going to be up in Alaska. If you look at the global extent right here, you can see that they show up in this teal color here. And you'll note that by far and away, they dominate the high latitudes. You can see Canada and parts of Greenland, parts of Asia, northern parts. And see this right in here, lower latitudes, what's that area?
Himalayas.
Yeah, it's the Himalayas. So you've got gelisols there because of the high elevations. You might see a few areas that pop up in the Rocky Mountains. These would be fairly high elevation soils. Their extent, at least in the Rockies, is probably not very well known. I think that the gelisols are one of the more recent additions to soil taxonomy, and they're only there's just not a lot known about where you find them in terms of the more localized areas. I suspect, you know, you think about Idaho and Washington. I don't know that Idaho has any, but Washington, around Mount Rainier, areas where you've got glaciers, you're probably going to have gelisols there associated with the highest elevations. So about 9% of the ice-free land area. And if you look at the United States, it's pretty easy because they're all going to be up in Alaska for the most part. They really don't show up on a map of the lower 48 in any detail. But if you look at Alaska, you can see that the coastal areas, the southeast Alaska and so on, not so much because a little bit more moderate temperature, but as you get up into the interior of Alaska, you get lots and lots of gelisols. And most of what we know about them, at least in this country, is because of what has been learned from looking at soils in Alaska. I mentioned that the gelisols were one of the more recent soil orders, and if you think about why is that? Well, I think people knew that they were there, but because there's so few folks that live on these soils, there really wasn't a lot of need for studying them or paying close attention. So I think they were largely ignored or not really studied that much. And so as a result, it wasn't until 1990 that they were added to the system. The thing about gelisols, if you think about the really cold climates, right in here it says, gelisols may occur on very old land surfaces, but because it's so cold, you don't really see much morphological development in them. Remember, it's water that really drives a lot of the soil forming processes, and if it's cold, you're going to have the water in a frozen state, and so you don't get this downward percolation and the translocation and weathering and things like that because of the temperatures. It says the low temperatures cause soil forming processes such as decomposition of organic materials to proceed very slowly. And as a result, gelisols tend to have fairly large quantities of organic carbon in them. The other note here, only soils, a wetland ecosystems such as histosols are going to have more organic carbon. There are exceptions to that, like the gelisols in the dry valleys of Antarctica, and I'll show you an example. The thing about land use, well, frozen condition of soil really is pretty limited to makes a lot of limitations for what humans are going to do. Obviously, you don't grow crops on these things, and they present some engineering problems that we're going to talk about here in a second. So a little bit about the classification, and I guess this is something else that I didn't mention earlier, but when we get into each of these soil orders, you should have a good idea of how within the gelisols, for example, the soils are broken out. So in other words, at the suborder level, what are the features that come out? And you can see right here, there are three suborders of gelisols, histels, turbels, and orthels. And if you look at this, this is just a general description of what these things are, but again, these would be the order in which they would key out, and the histels are the ones that have a large quantity of organic matter. They're essentially organic soils, but they're organic soils that have permafrost, and you recognize, this form of development, hist, you'll like in histosols, you'll see that again. Then the turbels, we talked about this word turbation. So these are the gelisols that have extensive evidence of the freeze-thaw processes or the mixing by frost action. And it's a dominant feature. The fancy name for that would be cryoturbation. I think we talked about that earlier. And then finally, the default category. So if it's not an organic gelisol and it doesn't have evidence of a lot of cryoturbation, then it would fall into the suborder of orthels. And this root orth, does anybody know what that means? You've probably seen it in other words.
Orthodontist.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that one, orthodontist. What's that?
There's like a pesticide.
Yeah, chemicals. Well, I think if you look at it kind of means simple, straightforward, it's just sort of, I think, good idea of a default category. And you'll see this in some of the other taxonomic groupings as well, where you've got this group that they're really defined by the lack of other features. And so this root orth will come in there. So common, I think, would be one way to interpret it. So one thing that we have done in order to try and visualize the soils within an order is to try these diagrams. Most of them are done as ternary diagrams, where up here, the top, these would be organic soils, mineral soils down here. This corner would represent those that have very little or relatively little cryoturbation. And over on the lower right-hand side, those that have a lot of cryoturbation. So you can see that the organic ones are going to be histels, turbels would be the ones with a lot of cryoturbation, and then the little cryoturbation mineral soils, mineral gelisols would be the orthels. So those are the three suborders. Now if you look at some of the examples here of the gelisols, and I just run through these images, you can look at them at home. One of the things, if you're interested, if you click on these, you'll get a larger, usually higher resolution image if you're interested or want to look at a little bit more detail. But you've probably all seen pictures of what's called pattern ground or polygonal patterns. And this is up in Alaska, and it's looking down on some this pattern ground near Prudhoe Bay. And you see the outline of these polygons on here. And I know all of you have seen this pattern in nature before. Where, anybody? You've seen it in a desert?
Kind of like the, a little bit.
Yeah, where else have you seen it? What does a mud puddle look like when it's dried up? You get those polygonal cracks in what's left there. This is just kind of nature's pattern where you have desiccation. In other words, you take something and you dry it out or you cause it to contract, and this is the pattern that you get, these polygons. And you'll see this pattern in nature at all scales. These things here on the landscape might be tens of meters across, and if you look in a dried up mud puddle, you know, it might just be a couple inches across, if that. So it really occurs at a lot of different scales. But what happens in these environments? When water freezes, it actually expands a little bit, but when you get something really cold, it contracts. And so what you're looking at, it's really kind of a contraction type of phenomenon that is causing what you see there. And if you look at a close-up, this next image here, this is these polygonal cracks, and so we're kind of looking in a crack here. You can see it goes up there. Here's the next polygon in the background. And they actually have a lot of micro relief because of the freeze-thaw processes. The center parts of these polygons tend to be depressional, and then around the edges, because of the active freeze-thaw processes, they tend to get built up. I think you can kind of see it here, how the edge is a little bit higher than the rest of it. And a lot of the rocks tend to get sorted out along the edges if there are rock fragments present. Just a really interesting type of arrangement of different particle sizes. Very characteristic of freeze-thaw environments. A couple profiles, you've seen this one before. This is an example of an orthel, or just the common variety. And you can see the horizons on here, a horizon. This is an O horizon, and then this down here is the permafrost, where you see the white. And you notice the designation there, C with an F on it. And remember, F stands for permafrost, okay? Now, a couple things about this. You notice the permafrost starts right in here, and I think it says it's a depth of 38 centimeters. So what happens on a seasonal basis is this upper part, the A and the OE horizon, when this picture is taken, they're thawed out. So this is probably taken in the summer. And this part, this upper part that does thaw out annually, is what's called the active layer. And then you get down to a certain depth and you hit this permafrost, and that's what stays frozen all the time. And a lot of studies that have been done or are being done on gelisols around the world, and in a lot of places what they're finding is that since they've been tracking this active layer is actually getting thicker and you can attribute that to whatever you want, but it may be, you know, warming, not necessarily global warming, but at least regional warming in places. So you get this active layer becoming thicker, and the depth to which you find the permafrost actually increasing a little bit. So the other thing here, you notice that there's a buried o-horizon right above that permafrost layer. Any idea why you might find an o-horizon there? It's kind of an unusual horizon sequence, an a-horizon, and then an overlying an O.
It's not warm enough down there to decompose the region.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good explanation, is that it's so cold there, and it's gonna be wet here too, because of when the ice melts, this is probably gonna stay fairly wet. And you end up with the conditions that just aren't very conducive to the decomposition of it. Yeah, right?
You say the depth is increasing a little bit. Is that like an inch over the last 10 years, or?
Well, it's variable. Most places, I'm thinking about some work that's been done in Alaska. They're looking at maybe, you know, 10 or 20 centimeters. But these are the kinds of measurements that you would have to take over a pretty long term, you know, to come up with a clear trend. But I would imagine, yeah, it's on the scale of maybe a few inches over a couple decades, perhaps, something like that. It's not 3 or 4 feet per year or anything like that. So I think this is a real good example, this O horizon in here, of how you get this decreased microbial activity and very slow turnover of organic residues. So they tend to remain in the soil profile in one form or another for long periods of time. A couple other examples. Here's a histel. Next one, and not a particularly good picture, but this is an organic soil. Here's the permafrost right down here at the bottom. One nice thing about working with gelisols is if you don't like to dig, you generally don't have to dig a very deep soil profile, depending on where you are, because this permafrost is going to be fairly close to the surface, and it's awfully difficult to dig through. So you can kind of see a little bit of stratification here. These are just different layers of organic material, and if you look back at the previous slide, you can see there's some mineral stuff mixed in here too. Here's an OI1, OI2, and C horizon, another OI, and then CF down there at the bottom for the permafrost. So greater than 20% organic matter by weight for these horizons in here. The other note, this particular profile is located in the center of one of those polygons like we saw in the first slide. And so a little bit of a depression, and it's probably going to be wetter than the rest of the soils that you'd find on that landscape, hence the domination of organic materials rather than mineral materials.
I have a question.
Yeah.
How do you get a sea horizon when you're surrounded by all this like organic matter? I just see brown. I don't see really much of a sea horizon.
Well, I think the reason for designating it as a C horizon or CF horizon is that it's soil material, but the fact that it is frozen and stays frozen means that there's really not much development to it, okay? So it has not been significantly altered by soil forming processes. And it could someday, imagine if the active layer continues to become thicker and the permafrost zone moves further down, yeah, maybe that'll become a B horizon someday. Time will tell, but I think just by convention, that's probably the best way to designate them at this point, because they really don't show a lot of alteration because they're frozen all the time. Okay, so these that I have been showing, one more example here from Alaska, and this one is an example of a turbell, one that has been subject to extensive cryoturbation. If we zoom in on the profile, again, kind of a hard picture, but do you really see distinct horizons in that thing? No, and part I don't, and part of the reason is, you know, you get bits of horizons here and there, but it's probably because of the freeze-thaw processes. And what it does is just churns the soil profile, and you end up with a fairly non-distinct set of horizons. It's kind of a difficult one to pick things out. There are some horizon designations put on here, but we talked about boundaries and how sometimes you have irregular or broken boundaries and horizons. This would be a pretty good example of it in there. And here, once again, the active layer down about 38 centimeters. Okay, now, these that I've just shown you from Alaska are, they represent the gelisols that have quite a bit of organic matter in them. You can see that they've all had O horizons somewhere in the profile. And the thing is, in Alaska, they don't get a tremendous amount of precipitation, but there's enough precipitation and it's cold enough that it's pretty effective. So when these things thaw out in the summertime, they tend to stay pretty wet because they're, well, number one, you've got the ice, the permafrost down below, and it's a short season. So if you've ever been up in Alaska, you know that it's a breeding ground for lots and lots of mosquitoes, and because of these wetter histosols. But there's a lot of gelisols, a lot of carbon in these things. Now, if you want to contrast that, here's something from the other side of the world, and this is a landscape from Wright Valley in Antarctica, and this is what are referred to as, this is one of the dry valleys. And just the note here, it says Antarctica as a continent averages less than 150 millimeters of annual precipitation, making it the driest and coldest continent on Earth. And dry valleys such as the one shown here may receive less than 50 millimeters of annual precip. That's not much at all. And as a result, the soils contain very little moisture, and they're characterized by what we call dry permafrost. The material is loose rather than ice cemented. So those Alaska examples, there's enough water in there that it freezes and you've got the soil basically looks like a dirty ice chunk, okay? Now if you look at the profile, here's this Wright Valley, here's the soil profile that goes with it. And you'll notice that you don't see that whitish layer in there. And in fact, if you dig this out, it's just all loose material because it's got such a low moisture content. There's not enough ice to hold the rocks and the other soil material together. So it's just loose. And you notice the designation here, CFF. You remember what the FF stands for? Yeah, that's the dry permafrost. So it's still characterized by being below freezing for most years anyway. And in this case though, it's very, very low water content. Yeah?
So if you're digging a pit, you wouldn't, because you said it's just very loose, so you would just say this is below 32 degrees and call it there, because would you be able to really tell, like with a shovel or?
Probably not. You know, it's not going to be as obvious as it would be in those examples from Alaska. And I think a lot of this, you know, the understanding of it is sort of based on some monitoring that's been done, because morphologically it's really difficult to tell. Well, what do you notice in terms of horizons that's missing from that soil profile?
The organic matter.
There's no O horizon, and in fact there's not even an A horizon. And the reason is, if you look back at the previous slide, how much vegetation you see there? There isn't any, at least in these dry valleys. And as a result, there's nothing growing up there in terms of vascular plants. So you've got very limited inputs of organic materials to these soils. And in fact, some of the studies that have been done in Antarctica suggest that there might be a slight increase in organic matter up there in the surface, but a lot of that is microbially derived. In other words, it's not from plants like we typically think of contributing to the formation of an E horizon. So in this case, they just designate a BW horizon right up there at the top because there is no darkening as a result of organic matter accumulation. The other note here, the active layer extends down about 45 centimeters, so somewhere right in there. And then the note there, the soil below the steps sufficiently dry, it's not ice cemented. And the lack of vegetation minimal biological activity preclude the formation of an A horizon or an O horizon for that matter. Notice the classification on this thing. This is a typic anhyorthel. Okay, you see the ending on there, EL, that's for gelisols, right? And then orthel, that was the common one, or the ones that aren't organic, or the ones that aren't characterized by extensive cryoturbation. And this term in here, anhy, or anhydra, means without water, right? An is without, H-Y-D. We don't have the D there, but that's for linguistics purposes. But it just, these would be the very, very dry, or what they call anhydrous conditions. And I think in a lot of these, it's less than, I believe, 3% water content on a weight basis. So really, really dry. And then you recognize that the subgroup, that term typic, which just means it's the garden variety. One of the things that you would notice if you went into the Keys to Taxonomy and looked at the gelisols, it is by far the shortest chapter in here, because there are fewer categories of gelisols than any of the other soil orders. They're just probably not that much known about them relative to mollisols. You know, mollisols, my God, it's probably 50 pages thick in there. So that's the big difference. So that's the dry variety of a gelisol. And a little bit about land use. Let's go back up to Alaska. And this is the base of operations in Prudhoe Bay for BP, who you always hear about BP in the news the last couple of years. But this is pretty good for illustrating some of the land use considerations with these soils. I guess the number one rule for doing anything on a gelisol is that you don't want to melt the permafrost, okay? So in order to prevent or minimize the amount of melting that takes place, all of the buildings that you see here, they're built up on a gravel pad. I think most cases there's about 4 feet of this gravel, and it just serves as an insulating layer above the soil. And then the buildings, you notice how they're up on stilts, which doesn't seem like a good design in a cold climate. But the idea there is to, again, minimize the heat transfer between the buildings and the ground. And here in the mid-ground here, you see this would be the gelisols. And during the summertime, you see how wet they are? Because you think about the water on a flat landscape, when that active layer thaws during the summer, where's the water going to go? Well, if it's flat, it doesn't have too many options. In a lot of cases, it just sits there and turns into a breeding ground for mosquitoes. But this is a good example of a lot of the construction that you'll see on permafrost. I've got a couple other examples. And the reason, really, for minimizing the heat transfer from the buildings or whatever it is, roadways, to permafrost is to prevent the melting and the conditions that result in something like this. And this is an example of what's called thermokarst. And this is a roadway that's put in, and one of the things that happens, if you put a roadway in, you'll notice there's trees in the background. You have to cut a swath of these trees, right, to put a road in. And when you do that, you take away some of the shading. Remember, this is pretty far north, so the sun's always going to be at a fairly low angle. But you get rid of some of that shading, it heats the ground surface up, or the road surface, and that heat gets transferred to the permafrost below. And in this case, it apparently, the water from the melting has somewhere to go, and you end up with a loss of volume below the soil surface as that water is removed, and boom, something like this happens. Imagine being on your way to work and come across something like that in the morning. And this is one of the things that has proven to be kind of difficult when you're trying to design roads and other structures, is to eliminate that or minimize the heat transfer as much as you can. And they didn't do it in this case. So what do you do about it? Well, there are a few steps that can be taken. And I think if you go to the supplemental material that I add here. Let's take a look at that. Here's an example of some, well, this map on the right, this is looking down, it's the North Pole right there, so it's a little bit different view of the Earth, but you can make out Alaska right here, northern Canada, and then here's parts of Russia, Siberia, and northern Asia. What these red dots represent are the major towns and settlements where you have some sort of concentration of population, and then the pink areas represent the smaller settlements there. And these are all areas that are considered to be at risk from melting permafrost. And this picture on the left is an apartment building in Siberia. And what happened is the permafrost underneath melted. I think in this case there was a water leak and the water kept dripping down into the ground and eventually melted enough of the permafrost that the whole the part of the building there collapsed. And so you see this kind of thing when you don't, you either don't have a very good design and there's a lot of thermal transfer from buildings into the ground, or an unfortunate water leak like in this case. Yeah, Bryce?
What do they do for like can they drill through it to get to a well or anything, or for like septic?
For, you mean in terms of an apartment building? Or
yeah, or just, I guess if you're gonna like have a house out there, or like that BP building, like where did their water come from? Were they able to drill through the permafrost to get down to a water source, or can they do anything?
In that case, I don't know. Because in some of these areas, the permafrost goes down for quite a ways, but eventually, I think most of you are aware, if you keep drilling down towards the center of the Earth, it's going to get warmer, right? So there's probably water down there at some point, but I guess the trick would be, you know, how thick is the permafrost? And in this case, I don't really know, but I think that would be a challenge for, yeah, septic systems and things like that. But I think it underscores just the problem with a lot of simple types of land use and what might happen. This is the Alaska pipeline, and I think all of you have heard about this, but this is one section of it, and this is an area of gelisols. And you notice what they've done is the pipe, normally when we think about a pipeline, we think about something that's buried. Well, they didn't bury the Alaska pipeline. It's propped up above ground, and it's got all of these pipes that you see that are holding it up, and they're specially designed to minimize the heat transfer from the surface, soil surface down into the soil. Because again, you've got this pipeline, you've got to have this swath of area where it's been, the trees have been removed so you can get to it for maintenance purposes. And so they're trying to reduce the thermal transfer there. And the note here said it added about $800 million to the construction costs.
And how can I avoid freezing inside the pipe?
How can they what?
Avoid the water getting frozen inside the pipe.
I don't know about the design of it. Why it doesn't freeze? Well, for one thing, it's oil, and I don't know what the freezing temperature is, but I suspect that if nothing else, it may not freeze, but it's going to get fairly viscous without some other way of warming it up. I don't know what they do. It's a good question.
I remember something other about being heated.
Yeah, I think there are parts of it that they did have to heat it for that reason. But so here's a good example. So it adds $800 million to the construction costs. Well, the fact that you have permafrost or any other limiting condition doesn't mean that you can't use that soil for something. It just means if you do successfully, it's going to cost a lot of extra money. And that's maybe a good lesson to keep in mind for what we're going to be doing in here this afternoon, where you start looking at the land use suitabilities for different soils based on their features. So you can still use it, but the final price tag is going to be considerably higher. And here's an image that I showed you earlier when we were talking about horizon designations. And this is one that gives you an idea of just how much the cryoturbation and the effects of the action of ice can have on a soil profile. Anybody want to hazard a guess as to what the suborder of this gelosol might be? Yeah, I'd say turbell would be a pretty good guess. And you notice that this profile is punctuated by this ice wedge in here. And I think the reason I had this in here is because it's an example of a W layer, which is for water. But in this case, it's frozen or ice and called an ice wedge. But you notice the permafrost horizons in here, CF1, CF2, that are being separated by this ice wedge. Remember this, the J? Remember what that stands for?
Doesn't that have to do with the churning?
Yeah, it's just a horizon that has a lot of evidence of cryoturbation. And it's kind of confusing because the single J was jarosite, which is an iron sulfate mineral, but the JJ means cryoturbation. And here you can see it's so mixed up, they've got two horizon designations for it. Interestingly enough, you notice there's a G in there for blade material, and that again indicates how wet some of these might be from time to time. But kind of a difficult thing in terms of coming up with a good coherent horizon description. Yeah?
So looking back to another histone like that, the fibra histone, that went to a CF horizon when it hit that ice wedge. And this one, they use a W designation.
Well, in those others, that's not an... See, the difference here is that if you took a chunk of this stuff and melted it, there would probably be very little soil material in there. It's essentially ice, okay? Whereas what we're looking at before, the CF horizon, if you took a chunk of that and melted it, there'd be a lot of soil in that. The ice is just really what's holding it together or cementing it together. So I'd think about those as being ice cemented, whereas this is just ice. Hannah, yeah?
It's because I have the cryoturbation, is it just from like the freezing and thawing, or is there any kind of burrowing animals that are adapted to like areas in gelosols? Like
That's a good question. As far as the wildlife, I don't know about burrowing animals. Normally you think about reindeer and polar bears and some of these grizzly bears, and some of these types of animals. Burrowing, I think in this case, most all of what you see is just the freeze-thaw action. And remember, when you have this upper part that is thaws out, as it starts to freeze, you'll get ice crystals that form, and then those ice crystals actually tend to attract water around them, and you kind of set up this net movement of water. And this is what causes a lot of those features where it disrupts the fabric. It's just a tremendous amount of movement and segregation of materials. You know, rocks get pushed up to the surface and outward and so on. Okay, last one. This is some work that was done in Antarctica. And kind of interesting because one of the things that we think about in terms of soil forming processes is salt accumulation. And normally we think about dry environments. Well, it turns out that some of these gelosols that are close to the ocean in Antarctica have a lot of salt in them, and it appears to be a function of age. So this graph shows the salt accumulation increasing as you go up the y-axis, and this is the approximate soil age or the approximate land surface age. And a couple things to note. First, this general trend that the older they are, the more salt that's accumulated there. And secondly, 250,000 years old, or excuse me, 2.5 million years old on some of these. As I said before, these gelosols, some of them are really old, but they don't show a whole lot of morphological development just because of the cold temperatures. But when we think of old soils, we generally think of lots of weathering and that kind of stuff, but not so with these guys. It's just, at least in this case, it's more salt accumulation. Okay, well that's it for the gelosol, and we'll move our way down the orders next time. So Tuesday we'll talk about histosols.